You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit, recording this week before a live audience inside the Irish Museum of Modern Art's cavernous and consecrated chapel. Now, from the flaneur to the urban psychogeographer, historical characterisations of the city walker cast individuals as deep-thinking aesthetes, untroubled intellectuals who are free to contemplate the strange idiosyncrasies of modern life and urban planning. But look around any metropolis today and the streets are full of people who cut a more harried figure. In the age of austerity, city walkers are assailed by the invisible slings and arrows of zero-hour contracts, astronomical rents, gentrification, an oppressive police force, and information technologies that are more effective spying tools than anything the Stasi could have dreamed of. Amazingly, despite this bleak reality, artists are still just about managing to make work, and in the city of Dublin, it's no different. Joining me this week to talk about their various activities in the face of metropolitan adversity are artists Sybil Montague.
Hi.
Emma Walsh.
Hi.
Kerry Guinan.
Hi.
Dan Toomey.
Hello.
Oisin O'Brien.
Hi.
And writer Megan Nolan is going to be reading some new work.
Hello.
But before we begin the show, here is Molly Garvey with her first performance of the evening, singing September.
The wind, it blew around us too, but there was no need to pay heed. We were safe, tucked away behind hearts and ideologies. We were the lovers of our endless tale that we spun so tirelessly. Half moon, half lit wonders, the wonders of wonder in the sight. Bitter trust crushed under dirty soul, I stop and sit in your eyes. The storm outside grew louder, running with scissors upstairs. The sheep, they huddled under the elm tree, pressing their face against stone. There's a bear in the mountain, which craggy, which cave is unknown. Never forget to put a bolt in your door, you live alone. Though the trees are falling, though the river runs dry, we shall sit one for the other and live long in the depths of our eyes.
That was Molly Garvey singing September. Sybil, you've recently moved back to Dublin from London. I mean, so has it been a massive change of pace moving between those two cities?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a massive pace. I guess coming back to Dublin was also coming back home with certain expectations, but I had been away for quite a long time, so things had changed a lot for the better. But also, London and Dublin, as we realise, are neighbours, so it's been easy to kind of have a move between the two places, I guess. Sorry.
And you're currently on a studio residency at Temple Bar Gallery here. Well, can you stay downtown in Dublin? Does that work? The same as New York.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, downtown Temple Bar, yeah.
And so what are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on an exhibition that's taking place later in the year, but really I've been working on plastic for the last few months, working on video and sculpture. So actually I'm in Fire Station at the moment in a sculpture residency. So
I was going to ask you about that. So basically, I mean, you up until now you've been working predominantly as an artist. And I want to talk to you about plastic in a second, but okay. When we were talking before about your practice, you told me that some of your earlier works were about carrying out the instructions for the creation of artworks, which made me think of Lucy Lippard's Numbers exhibitions. Mm-hmm. Whose instructions were you carrying out? Were they from the sort of the 6 years that she wrote about, or whose instructions were they?
They were actually Alan Kuprow's instructions, so for it to form happenings, and Mark Boyle, also who's worked with the Liquid Light shows. So it was just a means of prompting work. I was building sculpture and installations in the studio, and I make film or I make video, but I came to it through sculpture, and film video became a way of containing that work.
So tell me about one of the things that you reenacted. How did it play out? So were you reenacting happenings?
Yeah, well, the instructions for the happenings are they're kind of uninstructions in particularly with Alan Kuprow's work. He talks about forgetting everything you know and forgetting performing the happening only once or so on. So it was very broad, but it kind of just... The emphasis was on the event or the experience. So if, even with sculpture, working with a lot of material, it was more about the material producing an effect or an experience.
And what sort of effect is produced? Because I suppose part of the idea of that particular wave of artist practice was about suturing the bond between communities. So to create a space where people weren't sort of discrete objects moving through space, but could come together and become politically activated as like a collective.
Yeah.
Was that what you were trying to reach for as well?
Not necessarily. It was actually because a lot of the performance happened in a studio and then the document was a video. It didn't have that political aspect, and I guess it kind of took it in a formal sense.
So, tell me some of the things that sort of happened when these happenings were reenacted.
Compositionally they were referring to paintings like Cubist or Kurt Schwitzer's assemblages, like creating these compositions or performative spaces. So one, Northern Fruit, I think that you saw, which is like with strobes and buckets. And also there's, they're kind of quite lo-fi, and I guess because they're only performed once, there was a lot of sound from the time from a fruit and veg factory that was leaked into the piece, which became an essential part of the work. But I guess, yeah, with the participatory or the political aspect that Kuprow had, that I kind of removed that aspect in one way and then reintroduced it when I was exhibiting it in an installation.
Yeah, because I mean,
that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Because some ways, it may have been a liberatory thing at the time, but now that participatory art has this kind of preordained function. If you do a participatory thing, this is what it's supposed to enact. So it's kind of interesting that you let it go that way and then just let it unfold as it unfolded. But let's talk about plastic. So when I arrived in Dublin a couple of weeks ago, and the whole city basically was kind of abuzz about this festival that you'd organised. So could you just maybe tell us about the festival and who else was involved in organising it?
Okay, so Plastic was or is a festival of artists moving image that took place in February over three counties or three venues in Galway, Cork and Dublin. It came out of a collaboration initially with this group called Critical Forum, which is a group discussion group around Artists Moving Image, and also Lux in London, Temple Bar Gallery in the Irish Film Institute. So it was, you know, a collaboration between individuals and institutions from the onset. And then the festival, four of us ran it as a festival board or curator board. And the event you saw was in Dublin, which was the final weekend, so it was a three days of screenings, talks and performance.
That must have been, are you feeling slightly more, you must have been so anxious during that time, because doing a festival in one city is enough. Why did you put yourself through that ordeal?
It was pretty ambitious, particularly for the first year, but I think from the onset, because collaboration had become, and actually initially the idea for the festival came out of a talk that happened at the IFI about resources for artists' film in Dublin, and archives and preservation and distribution and so on. There was a lot of voices at that meeting, and so the collaborative element was quite important. And in Galway and Cork, we invited curators that were located there to create those events.
And the night that I managed to catch was Gerard Byrne and his... Yeah.
Sarah Pierce, his partner.
How did that come? So how did you start to broach all these relationships? You figured out you were going to do a plastic film festival, and then you started to think about, well, what form is it going to take? Who are we going to invite to do things? How did that work?
There's a template. The cinema, the partnership with IFI, cinema context, so all the films were screened in a cinema. And all the discussions took part in Temple Bar in the gallery, and it was important to have that bridge between the two venues. And they're actually located quite close to each other, which is... Gerard Byrne and Sarah are both significant artists working with Artists Moving Image at the moment in Ireland. And then from there, we kind of, you know, used a lot of connections and suggestions of different people that we wanted. We wanted to bring a lot of people to Dublin who are working with Moving Image.
And why, I mean, did you feel that, as well as your own passion for Moving Image, I mean, what did you want to instill in the audiences that were coming to see the films that are on display?
I don't think there was any pre-idea, but really about bringing a lot of work here that hadn't been screened before. And the discussions then became a really integral part of that. And then having this huge range of work, like, you know, between when we were getting all the film formats, actually it was just amazing, the 35mm and 16mm and digital files and DCP and Beta. It was kind of a nightmare, but also amazing to realize all this. So, I mean, and those contrasts were reflected in the program between, like, really, you know, like Hannah Sautel did a performance which was a really kind of high-end digital noise, really loud performance with CGI animation, to Wilhelm Helm, who actually an artist in Peter Taylor's program called Plastic Passion, and he only travels with his work, or rather his work only travels with him, and he brought these amazing 35mm prints of there's dyed celluloid film, which were just incredible to see on a huge screen, cinema screen format.
Yeah, I was really impressed actually, because when I saw the Gerard Byrne, Sarah Pierce program, I was like, oh wow, are they going between formats? Were you going between formats at that screening?
Well, yeah, that was the only one. Thankfully, Lux helped us out and put it on one.
And it did.
That was the only. The other ones did move between, but there was 20 works, I think, in Jared and Sarah's, and it was quite intense. It would have been really, and we want. I guess you would have had a real stop and start, which is you kind of have to ask the audience to
concentrate and
kind of ran continuously, and then that one, the duration of 1 minute, 1 minute, 2 minute, 2 minute was quite important.
So yeah, just to, so people, for people who weren't there, so basically what Gerard and Sarah were doing was like they developed a film screen program, which is like hour and how long was it, 70 something?
Yes, 70 minutes.
70 minutes, yeah. And it basically films were selected in relation to their duration. So there'd be films selected that were 1 minute, and the time scaled up as the program.
5 minutes.
Up to 5 minutes. Yeah. So it started with 1 minute films and ended with 5 minute films.
Yes. Yeah. From the Lux Archive. Yeah.
And again, so on the night that I was there and the talk that happened afterwards, it was really well attended. There was a massive buzz about it. So I'm just really keen to know what your plans are for the future of the festival.
Well, we were really encouraged by the level of engagement, and I think a lot of connections were made between people, you know, even outside, that are going to continue on outside. And I guess we intend to continue with the festival, but also the critical forum is continuing on, and there's other areas of activity around artists moving image in Dublin that are kind of all percolating at the moment. So,
yeah. And you mentioned to me something about it possibly becoming a biennial.
Yeah, a biennial.
Oh, you know what? I never know how to say this. Is it biennial, biennial, or biennale? Yeah. Is it up to you?
It's up to you.
Okay, all right. Well, let's biennial. Okay. But like the other thing I wanted to ask, and I want to open it up to Dan, Daniel. I didn't say Daniel before we started the show. Dan said to me, Morgan, you have to say my name as Daniel, otherwise I'm going to get in trouble. So I apologise.
But just for my mum. Yeah. She gets upset at the idea that I've changed my name or something.
So if Miss Toomey is listening, it's my...
Ms. O'Donnell.
Ms. O'Donnell. Oh, Jesus Christ. I should just go now. I'm really... Apologies.
She's very particular about names.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. But, Sybil, you... What's interested in is, like, both Sybil... Dan and Ashin, you guys work as artists, or you are artists, but also there's some other stuff happening over the top of that. Maybe not necessary for you, Ashin, but Sybil, certainly you're working as a curator. Like, so how do you juggle those two, consciousnesses or professional modes of being?
I guess selfishly, as an artist, seeing all those works and being able to have kind of a level of intimacy with all these works is great, but I'm not sure. So far I'm either one or the other. I haven't managed to be both at the same time.
So, okay, Dan and Ashin, so let's bring you two guys in. So when I first met you, actually Ema took me over to see you guys in a space that was called Basic Space. And we all sat around in the room with some portable heaters, and you guys were sort of telling me all about how the project was working. So, I mean, how do you, maybe just for people who don't know, tell us like a bit about what is Basic Space, how long has the project been running for?
Right, well, Basic Space came into being in either 2009 or 2010. I never really remember, I wasn't involved at the time. It was started by four art students who were in their second year, who none of whom are still actively involved. And I think they'll forgive me for saying that it was, you know, probably quite a just enthusiastic, naive maybe thing of just, we want to have exhibitions. We don't know how that happens, and no one is really presenting us with opportunities to do it, so we'll do it ourselves. And I got involved quite quickly and started to, just out of the same impulse really, enthusiasm and naivety. And I never really intended to do anything like that. I just wanted to be an artist, but it sort of seemed necessary and seemed to be kind of exciting, and so I did it. And I'm still doing it for those same two reasons, I think. But it's a group that basically runs contemporary art projects, and those sometimes take a very short form, like a one-day event, and sometimes they are a two-year studio running thing that we're doing at the moment for the last 2 years. But I try and think of them all as being projects that have a purpose and have a sort of a core center. And Ashin has been involved in this two-year project.
I initially did, Basic Space had a residency here when they were in between the two buildings, and then they opened it up for other people to come in and do projects. So I was there for the last 2 weeks, and then the next week moved straight into the new building.
So just to appraise of what you basically just said, is like Basic Space is like a cooperative gallery space and also studio space. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a kind of a catch-all term for all the things you want and need when you immediately leave art school and don't know how to get the things you want and need. And so we sort of put them all under one roof. and have been struggling, and I think happily struggling, and not really struggling to resolve, but struggling with that kind of identity crisis ever since.
So how, maybe give us, how many people are involved in Basic Space, like on, do you have like, is it like a curatorial board?
Yeah, well, there used to be just the people who did it were the people who did it, and we were called Basic Space, and that was simple. And then when we opened this new studio, suddenly there were six of us who did things like answered phone calls and wrote letters to the insurance people and whatever, and we needed a different name. Or maybe we were already calling ourselves directors, I can't remember. But we're called directors anyway, which I don't really know why. And it's fine, I don't mind that. That's a good thing to be called. And that's the difference between me and Oisin, is he's not one. But there's now... No, but I mean, Oisin is as vital as I am. But there's two of us who are called directors still now, or who are active in it every day. And then there's about sort of a varying cast of about 10 or 11 other people who use the studio and who contribute ideas for projects and are involved.
So, Oisin, are you part of this, the other cast?
Yeah, the other cast.
How does it feel to be the other guys?
I think as soon as we moved in, it was made quite clear that it was kind of an open thing and that you wanted us to be involved and like not just kind of pay rent and treat it like a 9-to-5, that it was an open thing. So I think that was exciting, and it's kind of nice to be in something where you can feel you can imprint into it.
And like when you first set it up, did you have a set period that you wanted to run Basic Space for? Did you have a goal that you were working towards once it was achieved, you're like, we're going to stop?
No, not at all for me. I mean, I wasn't there on the first setup, and I don't know, I think... Probably the first setup was really the same as my entrance to it, which was just this kind of, like, incredibly excited, probably maniacal inability to see the future, just, like, totally living in one moment and being, not even being able to think about the future. And so, no, there was never anything like a set or a limit put on it, and it just was going to keep going until no one cared about it anymore.
So when I was asking Sybil about how she balances those two roles as a curator and artist, it feels to me that Basic Space teeters on the edge between amateurishness and professionality, and that in between there you're kind of uncomfortable with tipping too far into being a professional.
Yeah, well, I'm a very unprofessional person. I'm really unsuited to the job, and like I'm not a sociable person. I'm not professional. I have, you know, I was kind of reminding myself not to swear on the radio tonight. I'm like really not the guy who should be doing this, but I started doing it, and I very kind of vainly thought that I didn't necessarily trust someone else to do it, so I wanted to do it, and so I'm still doing it. But yeah, definitely I don't see myself as a professional in, or I kind of only reluctantly see myself as a professional in those terms.
And what has it meant for your own practice? Has it fed back into how you view... Because I suppose one of the things that people work through as an artist is coming to know themselves in some ways. Not necessarily as romantic as that, but, you know, just practically, who am I? What do I want to do? So what? How does that feed back into what you're doing as an artist?
Well, someone asked me the other day if I've ever experienced...
We were talking about this
yesterday. Yeah, you and I were talking about whether or not you've experienced creative block. And I think one of the great things about having a thing that isn't directly my practice is that I have loads of time when I don't have to worry about it and things develop. And so probably when I come back to do like 4 weeks really hard making my own work, I usually have lots of thoughts ready. And also, I wouldn't do anything that Basic Space does if I didn't find it interesting in itself. So it's like a second... I used to describe it as being when we were still in art school and we had this big vacant, or up until we occupied it, vacant warehouse across the road. I used to talk about the art school as being like Wayne Manor, and that as being the Batcave, where you could go and put on this other identity and call yourself Basic Space and do things that didn't make sense necessarily with what you were trying to narrativize into being your own work and that you were presenting to a college assessor or whatever, but that was all this other kind of offshoot things that came out and were interesting and seemed worth doing.
Oisin, how is it for you? Because you're not the director,
yeah.
But you're working in that space, seeing all those different things happening around it. So I just wonder what does it feel like for an artist? Because usually, I mean, the romantic idea is that you're just in your garret with your colour palette, and the new one is like you're in the big space of loads of people. But this is slightly different because there is a kind of organisational thing behind it. So what's it been like for you?
I think there is that feeling at times where it feels like you're watching someone else play solitaire over their shoulder and trying to tell them to move the red jack. But like at the same time, maybe there's the other bits, the unpleasant bits you get to see that I don't want to do, and then I can just go back to my desk and back to my work and not have to deal with that side of it. So,
and look, what about like when you're, so you've got a new exhibition up at the moment, haven't you?
Yeah, well, it's new, but it's also old because it ends tomorrow at noon. So,
by the time this goes out, it'll be finished. But who put that exhibition on? Like, was that one of the people who has a studio at Basic Space, or was it a proposal that was sent in?
No, yeah, that was a reasonably unconventional case where we've never had really very much to do with painting. I think partly because the people we've attracted have been interested in kind of big, echoey, fairly dingy spaces, and partly because big, echoey, fairly dingy spaces have never seemed to us, like, I quite like painting, but it's never seemed like a very appropriate place to do a show. But this guy, Joshua Sex, who is a painter, sent us an email. I don't think he'd ever curated anything before, and he said he wanted to curate a painting show, and he sort of maybe perversely wanted to do it in a place that wasn't very suited to it. And so he wanted us to come up with a solution to that. So we accepted that kind of as usual because it was weird and exciting and interesting. And, you know, I'm not really in the habit of accepting exhibition proposals, but that sometimes something happens, like, I think you're the wrong space for this exhibition, so I want to do it there. And you think, yeah, okay, we have to do that. So we came up with some solutions to do that and put a painting show in a non-inappropriate place.
And one of the things that we were talking about when I last saw you was that there was some uncertainty about the future of Basic Space being in that same space. Is that right? Or, I mean, I guess I'm working my way towards thinking about like, how are you, what's the plan now from this year into 2016? Do you know that you've got the space still, or are you thinking that you might have to, you know, pack your bags and jump and find somewhere else?
Well, it's always precarious because our lease is with the City Council and it's an 11-month lease and it gets renewed sometimes quite late into the 11th month. So it is always hard to say and it is always precarious, but again, as like in the same way as all the things I was saying at the beginning about how unsuitable I am for this, I quite like that. And, you know, probably in November when we didn't know if we were going to stay or not, I didn't like it, but now I'm once again like, yeah, okay, but maybe next November. I don't, you know, it's, as I said, it's only good for as long as someone cares about it, so that almost is a test of metal. You know?
And how supportive have the City Council been?
Well, I suppose very, in that we have this space that's really, really cheap and really great and is kind of still going, and that's the arts office of the City Council. So I think that they're quite pleased when they are able to do something. And I think that they find it probably quite difficult to make things happen because they pretty much always are negotiating with other offices of the City Council who are probably less interested and care less and don't really want to have 13 artists in a big room, but they don't have. So when the time comes when they find another office who no longer can really defend not having artists in whatever big room they have available, I think they're really excited and they are really supportive, but they're only as supportive as they can be, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because there's like a sense of precarity about what's happening at Basic Space, which mirrors like the sense of precarity that we all feel as people living in cities today.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be perverse by fetishizing it. You know, I know that it's a big problem and it would be better if it was my choice to enjoy the fact that I might just run away one day. I do think there should be sustainable models in place, but maybe they should be put in place by someone who wants to put them in place and who doesn't see this as some weird bat cave, you know.
I think you're doing a pretty good job though, from what I've seen.
I'll let Oisin.
Oisin, what do you think?
As my client.
Yeah, I think if it got too, like if it was too far planned in the future, it would stop being Basic Space, and then it wouldn't have that kind of same dynamism to it.
Yeah.
Well, after I met you guys that first night at Basic Space, and we sat around the portable heaters, and then we went to the pub, and that's where I bumped into Megan Nolan. who had just turned up, and unbeknownst to me, you just won, or you were just taking part in like a short.
The Moth.
Yeah. What? Sorry.
The Moth.
Yeah.
Spoken word event.
And you, what did you win?
It's just progression to the next part of it, sort of. Cash-free prize.
So what? One of the things that I noticed when I first arrived here in Dublin is that I went to an event called Words in the Warehouse, which is where I met Molly, who's singing this evening. And I was surprised by it just really seemed like a healthy scene of people reading the poetry or reading stories and essays. And then when I met you again, you'd come from another event. And then I think in between like 1 week, there was about four different storytelling events that I'd seen. But your particular practice is quite personal, isn't it? I mean, could you talk a little bit about, you when we met before, you were telling me that you've been writing these essays for a while.
Yeah, so when I started writing, I did a lot of different things. I wrote poetry for a long time, and I wrote comedy and did stand-up for a while. And then for the last 2 years or so, I've been writing mainly personal, kind of confessional essays. So I've been working with that sort of style for the last while, and I'm kind of trying to consider at the moment whether I want to stay with it and how to play with it and what I want to do with that tone and not necessarily keep it completely non-fictional.
And I was quite surprised when you said that you were doing stand-up comedy, not just because I rarely hear people saying that, not because I was like, you're quite a dry person. it's rare to meet people doing that, and I think it takes a certain amount of courage to do. So what are you still doing it now?
Or? No, I stopped about 2 years ago. I think that you'd have to be a lot braver to do it in really mainstream venues, which I didn't do. It was a really tiny kind of alternative comedy scene, and in Dublin that means there's like 15 people at everything that you're doing, so it wasn't that intimidating. So as soon as I started to try and get out of that, I realised that I was really bad at it. I went to Edinburgh and did the Fringe and stayed there for like 2 weeks, and it was just very depressing looking at all the like couples who just wanted to laugh and not, you know, be made to read out things they didn't want to say.
But then you skip from that, which is you're quite a vulnerable position, to writing quite personal essays, which is also another vulnerable position. Mm. So what made you approach that kind of, I don't want to say confessional to make it have sort of connotations when we're in a chapel, but yeah, for want of a better word, those sort of confessional mode, what made you go towards that?
I used to just write for the college newspaper when I was in Trinity, and they asked me to, they would just pitch very arbitrary ideas, and I wasn't that good at like investigative journalism. And so I think once it was actually, I was still writing for them, but I had dropped out of college and I was unemployed at the time, and they asked me to write something about being unemployed. And that was kind of the first thing I wrote in this style. And it was just because I had no real insight into unemployment on a big scale, so I just wrote about a very personal account of what it was like for me to be unemployed. And so I found that really freeing, kind of to be vulnerable like that, but to own things that I had been kind of ashamed of about being unemployed and about being not in college when everyone else was. And I found that it made me feel good to talk about things that I would otherwise be ashamed of in public.
So what are you going to read for us this evening?
So this is a story that I've just written. It's called It Was and It Was Not So. And the reason I called it that was I read a quote a couple of days ago that it was like kind of traditional Spanish storytellers would say this, it was and it was not so, before they started. I just thought it was interesting because of what I'm trying to do at the moment, which is to take some of the things that I like about my essays and turn them into not necessarily completely autobiographical work. So is it? The actor was beautiful once, frowning out at us from her mother's soaps and occasional advertisements for insurance and milk. His beauty was obtusely meaningful in the way of the best celebrities, the ones I look eagerly back at on screen, wishing to ease whatever ancient pain it is that softens their eyes so. The actor aged slowly and then all at once. The decades of accumulated opening night camaraderie, the packets of filched Bensons and tables of sweating cheddar and vinegary wine clung to his face and robbed it of its mystery. When I was younger, I dropped out of drama college in order to suffer a prolonged mental breakdown alongside a succession of depressed boyfriends. I thought of my rejection of the Academy as a move of intellectual boldness to be recounted triumphantly in the best-selling memoirs of my later years. I was arrogant and lazy and mildly brilliant, writing 3,000-word essays in bed the morning they were due, and in the evening retiring to write terrible poetry late into the night over fried egg sandwiches and black coffee in the shop next to my house. The Italian waiters fussed over me and gave me unsold tiramisu, which I pretended to ignore and then wrapped in paper towels to keep for breakfast. I woke face down on a rotating selection of the city's carpets and took the train for free to my morning class. If the conductor accosted me, I feigned a French accent, or wept in French, until such time as the doors opened automatically and I ran away. I arrived just in time for class, which I nevertheless did not attend, instead watching my friends troop in clutching laptops, furious at them for leaving me to occupy the meat of the day alone. On weekend afternoons, I could be found wandering up and down Camden Street, juggling an armful of newspapers and phone chargers and cigarettes, waiting for a party to emerge. I narrated my life through brief affairs with chaotic but tepid men, each new arrival dictating the places I would drink and the levels of irony with which I would approach popular films and listen to dance music. Going to college began to seem like an unacceptable interruption to reality, which was other people, and whatever engagement I could drain from them. Although I had stopped attending class or writing assignments, my teachers tolerated my continued presence in rehearsals and performance. This was because I was the youngest and prettiest of all the girls, and affected a dry patrician aloofness which appeared to a surprising number of people to be a talent for acting. I exaggerated the clipped, wealthy voice I had inherited from my English father. I was wide-faced and makeup-free, and looked at all times like I had been recently scrubbed. I wore men's corduroy trousers and suspenders and unflattering work shirts, beneath which you could easily make out my fashionably small and free breasts. We all dressed like that then, with precariously balanced blonde topknots wobbling, as though to draw a knowing arched eyebrow above how lovely we knew we were. We wore jodhpurs and bowling shirts with the names of working class men sewn into them, cocktail dresses and hiking boots. Were we beautiful? Of course we were. We were in our 20s. I starred in 6 different plays that year, in each one reprising my exquisitely vacant impression of a jaded Mitford sister. I was performatively kind to the costume lady and the stage crew, bringing everyone pastries in the mornings and Chinese food at night, flitting between them all to gossip. I myself forgot what food was, growing ever more attached to my image as a tiny beloved sprite whose role it was to be laughed at indulgently and petted like a kitten. I suckled frozen grapes in the dressing room and enjoyed the silent approval from the other actresses as I did so. My collarbones were sharp and easily smashable, and I could wrap my arms around my whole body and feel like I was cradling the baby of myself. After one opening night, the director pulled me through the crowded theater foyer where we were downing paper cups of red wine, out into the yard to suggestively put a cigarette in my mouth and desperately palm my ribs. He rubbed his unshaven face against mine in the wrong direction, and the coarse feel of it was hard to take. The pleasant smell of beer and cold wind on his face reminded me of how my parents would smell when they came home from a night out, let the babysitter go and came to kiss me goodnight. It was the safest smell in the world. I could smell outside on them, but I was home and now so were they. "Baby," the director moaned, leaning his head down into the nape of my neck and starting for some reason to cry. "Baby." I went on tour. The play was a modern reworking of Othello, as everything in theatre is now obliged to be a modern reworking of things people do not care about anymore. This version made some oblique and meaningless connection to the economic downturn, the text remaining untouched, so that it was just Othello, but played by people wearing suits and headsets. The characters all ostentatiously used iPhones to better highlight the daring juxtaposition. This sent our audiences into nightly spasms of the mildly scandalized tittering common to bourgeois theatre goers across the world. It was the first time I had met the actor, though I had seen him in other productions, and marveled at how nearly young and nearly beautiful he was. The features were still so clear and fine, and seemed always to be attempting escape from the reality of his face. There was something potent about his physical confusion between boyhood and elderliness, as there was in the fact that it was clear he did not know if his career would have a second act or not. It was like watching someone in the throes of adolescence, neither quite one thing nor the other, but violently them both at alternate moments. We all knew that his chance at stardom had passed and probably never existed, but an air of glamour still hung around him. He behaved as though at any moment a call might come through and he would be forced to abandon us for something better, starrier, less regional. And so we fell in line and treated him with due awe. And then, too, there was the simple excitement of seeing how pliable and porous his familiar face really was. He was funny and warm and overly tactile in that way that people who have been watched for a living for too long naturally become, always beckoning me over and slinging a casual arm over my chair. He shook his head in mock wonder when I spoke about anything important to me, which was nothing. I had interests once, I was sure of it, but now I merely performed those interests because they sounded good in conversation with men and made them shake their heads in mock wonder. I had a set number of spiels I could haul out about books or plays or cultural theory, all precise and academic enough that they sounded convincing, but vague enough that they could not be criticized. If in doubt, I would ask the man what he thought and then cry, "Yes, yes, exactly," and clutch his forearm and move my face a little closer, eyes wide and mouth apart, as though baffled by the dazzling insight. It was easy to love him because of how base and stupid his unhappiness was, how neat the arc of his brief glory and predictable disappointment. Here was a story I had heard many times, one I could really believe in, an underdog I was used to cheering for. He told me all the tragedies of his life in one slippery rush, reddened by whiskey and wet-eyed, the deaths of his parents, the alcoholic Irishness of his upbringing, his girlfriend being killed in a car accident. "Nobody knows this," he whispered, "but I had two children with my first wife. She moved away and I never tried to find them." He was crying now. I let him lie his heaving head on my lap, and I thought, good, have two children. Have more children. Have 1,000 children we must track down and mend relationships with. Have so many dead ex-girlfriends you'll never be innocent again. Be such a terrible drunk that we must spend decades talking about it. Have so many problems that we have no choice but to make it our life's work to solve them together and never think of any other thing. When we slept together, he looked past me at the walls of the hotel. I did not acknowledge that I was there. I didn't mind. This was the most perfect iteration of my tininess and of acting. I was disappearing, and it felt so good to be nothing, to be purely of use and have no decision to make. Let me be completely still if that's what you want. Or let me fade entirely into the sad stripes of the hotel wallpaper if my being still is not still enough for you. Or let me be less than nothing. Let me be a completely boring thing that will not excite you at all, but which still can be of use, like a clothes hanger or a fork. Once he hit me sharply, just once and never again. And as my ear rang, I thought about how that meant that a particular pitch was dying, and I would never hear it again once it had finished dying there. That pitch belonged to him now, and I wondered how many other pitches I could give to him, if there were other noises he could relieve me of.
Megan, that was an incredible piece of writing there. And I like the way there seemed to be this tension between the omnipotence of the voice talking, who is seeing everything happening, but then also this almost someone with a deity-like understanding of people around them, but also this other tension of them wanting to disappear or disappearing, which is really, really good. Tell me the title again.
It Was and It Was Not So.
Amazing.
Thank you.
So where can people find some of your work?
I have most of the essays I've written are on my profile on medium.com, so it's just medium.com/Megan Nolan.
So I think definitely check out Megan's website, because I think she's a remarkable writer, and that was quite breathtaking. I think everybody here has taken somewhere quite strange and disturbing, but we loved it. My favourite was wide-faced and makeup-free. I'm gonna. That's nice. So now to Emma Walsh and Kerry Guinan. So I suppose while everyone else on the panel was burdened with extra artist roles, extracurricular roles, you guys aren't. You're just working as artists at the moment. Or maybe Kerry, let me start with you, because you were previously at NCAD, but you're not anymore. So, tell me a bit about your practice.
Oh, okay. I wasn't expecting this question at all from what you said before. okay. My practice is mostly informed by my politics and my political activism, writing way of looking at the world, which comes from kind of feminist Marxist perspectives. Right now, I'm not sure right now. Previously, the most recent work I have been doing, which was the last couple of months, I'm in a residency in Block T for a year to do research on it, and I'm going in residency in Slovenia to do research on it, is about artist-run spaces, like Basic Space, that are popping up in the years of austerity in Ireland, and how now that the market is seen to be improved, or improving, how they're being shut down. So it's my work responds to austerity politics, and it does so in a way which kind of implicates the institutions that I'm working in. So it's so far it's been very site-specific work. Last summer I was based in a little gallery called 126 in Galway that has been run by a group of really hard-working people, a rotating group of hard-working people for about 10 years. So I was making work about their funding issues and their position of being unpaid.
And how does that work manifest then? Because, I mean, in some ways you're dealing with quite concrete things. So how do they get filtered into the work that you're doing, or how do they become formalised?
I kind of embody the system, I embody the systems that I'm critiquing in my work. And an important characteristic is that embodiment, but it's also that I always implicate myself, the artist. Because I don't think I'm free of anything I'm critiquing either. I don't think anyone is. So I'm very present in my work, which often takes the form of kind of delegated performance or legal agreements. So two works I did in 126. The first was for their annual members exhibition in July 2014. And that was a group show of members of the gallery. And in advance of the exhibition, I hired the head technician of the gallery, Marcel, to paint the entire floor in preparation for it. But he had to do it with a very, very small brush. And I paid him minimum wage per the hour for his labor. So then in the exhibition itself, I mean, all the other artworks are present, but at the same time was the contract, the employment contract between us. I really, really, really enjoy subverting legal language. It's my favourite hobby. So that was on the wall. And then you could see its gestures on the floor. And then after that, I was awarded a residency there for 2 months at the end of summer. And my work for that was to become a sponsor to the gallery. So I paid them a sum of money. And in return, they had to change their name legally to 126 Copyright Kerry Guinan. And that work was mediated through press release and amended signage on the gallery front.
And then you were saying, when we were just joking before about being burdened by other things, I mean, you're talking about being a waitress, so it's like you're taking these sort of oppressive structures that are in place, alienation of labour, and then bringing them over to inform your practice. And what's it like for you then to go back to this other role?
I think it's an important dictum in my work that I'm embodying a capitalist persona, but at the same time, I am the precarious worker as well, which is why I think it's important that I do implicate myself, because it draws on more than the fake kind of capitalist carry and the victim, because I'm also the victim of my own work, and I fund it myself. So through it being presented as artwork that is made by an artist, you know, one of the first questions I'm usually asked is, how did you afford it? And whether or not I reveal that is kind of irrelevant, but even that people are talking about how much money can an artist actually have that they can afford to employ someone else, and especially considering that I'm only out of college and stuff. And I'm not sure whether if I can credit my waitressing job to any of these theories at all, but I mean, you know, another really important part of my practice is that I'm actually directly involved in activism and political writing. I try anyway to do some of that as well. So I've, it's kind of a full set of practices that then come together as a direct action in artwork.
And Ema, I just want to bring you in now. Okay. So I came across an image of one of your works previously, and it made me, I thought about minimalism. It was the red construction of the TV, like a screen in the centre. I formed my own impressions about that, but I was wondering if you could just talk a bit about some of the ideas that underpin your work.
Sure. So that was that particular work that you saw is one of three in a series of really quite large-scale sculptures that are formally informed by minimalism, but also interface design and furniture design, which sort of ape that visual language, but at the same time try and talk about the relationship between grammar, gender, and sometimes violence. So that particular work was an enormous red comma over 2 meters high and 2 meters by 4 meters. So if you imagine drawing a comma on the ground, that's 2 meters by 4 meters, and then it like grows up. So it like towers above your head, and you probably have to like walk around it for it to even be intelligible. And then embedded into the skin of that is a video in which three characters, a man, a woman, and a dog, each try to explain how they were conceived by their parents and also how they got their name, but they do it through citation of their parents who function as unreliable narrators in the story. So that work is kind of just like a massively inflated piece of punctuation that sort of then has this element embedded in it which tries to problematize it.
And it feels to me that I think both you and Kerry, you're dealing with levels of complexity that are quite fascinating, really. Your works take some unraveling, let's say. They take some. You can't just walk in, see one of your pieces, and walk out. You have to invest some intellectual effort in understanding. And that's not a denigration. It's just an observation, I think.
I think that in my work, there's the possibility to. Okay, so maybe in some ways the way in which minimalist sculpture is austere and solemn, and it also kind of maybe specifically kind of male, is makes it kind of an easy target for this kind of like aping or queering or whatever. But it's also it also has a direct effect as an object that I am completely invested in as well. So as well as sort of undermining or having this kind of complexity, engaging with it just as a sculptural object that you have a physical relationship to and that it has an impact in the way that you move around a space or, I think that definitely those sculptures are things that you can engage with on whatever level, and I'm happy with either of those.
You're both involved in an artist group, mm-hmm. Is that right? Could maybe don't necessarily talk about the other people's involvement in it, but maybe could you talk to me a bit about your experience of working together in the artist group and what you are trying to achieve, I suppose?
Yeah, when we were in fourth year in undergrad, we've been working together for a long time previous to that, but me and Kerry and Saoirse Wall, Taryn McKeown, Avril Caroon and Renee Helena Brown started working together as a group, first kind of as a crick group and then as a group that exhibits together. That, for example, that piece that I just talked about is from a show that we co-curated and we're kind of continuing to work together on that, and it's because we kind of got a set of related interests.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you seem... you're very aware of what you're doing, and you're aware of the positions that you're taking in relation to other stances. So working with other people is difficult at the best of times. Yeah. So what's it like when you two work together? Do you find it quite an easy process? Or?
Well, I mean, we didn't seek people out to work with. It was a completely organic thing that happened. Some of the six of us had collaborated before on several things together. Maybe not all at once, but there was kind of natural collaboration. No one can see my hand gestures on radio, it's pretty disappointing. I don't think there have been... I haven't found it difficult ever. I found it to be the best presence in my practice. Really, really, really supportive. And you know, I think we learn a lot through each other, because although we might have similar agendas and similar styles of thinking, we all have very different research avenues and mediums, even like that basic thing. We all work in very, very different mediums. And we might kind of disagree about the function of our work in different ways, but I mean, it's really interesting for my practice to navigate through five other practices at the same time and to be influenced by them and take positions in relation to them. And it makes my work stronger. And it's also just really helpful on a very practical level of having people around you who will always be there to talk to you and give you feedback.
It's actually a privilege to have, like my practice has been almost exclusively collaborative since I've like come into college, and when you find people that are really amazing to work with, I don't know if this is like interesting to other people, it's like, oh my god, it's so good, but when you get into a position like that and it is actually good to work with people, then it's like, that's the best thing that there can be.
And you guys, you don't, there's no name for the group, and
there's,
so
there's six names.
There's six names, yeah. one of the, I just wanted to say that I saw one of your proposals that we won't necessarily talk about because it's still in gestation, but I just wanted to say that I was startled by how accomplished the group was and how coherent this group of six people who didn't want to have a name necessarily and were really observant of each member's specific ideas and specific approach to making work. So I'm just excited to see what you guys are going to produce in the future. So can you give me a slight hint without
teaser.
Yeah. Something? What's gonna?
We're gonna do a show together soon.
Is that all you're gonna get?
Yeah.
So where can I mean?
It's gonna be excellent.
And I kind of would like to be able to point people towards somewhere where they can get some sense of what you're doing. Is that possible at the moment?
Not as a group.
We've got websites.
Yeah, we've got individual websites. I think maybe the function of our group is for ourselves, and we don't.
Say the name of your website.
Okay, my website is cargocollective.com/Kerry Guinan.
Oh, mine is www.emerwalsh.com, but I've had to buy my own domain name off myself this week, so it's not going to be up for another week. It's just this like stupid thing where I've like emailed myself being like, can I buy?
Yeah, I saw it. So now, hopefully now you're out of that Ouroboric nightmare of being the snake that's eating your own tail, and you're back with us in reality. But with that, we've come to the end of the show, and I just want to say a big thank you to Sybil Montague, Dan Toomey, Daniel Toomey, sorry mum, Oisin O'Brien, Jesus Christ, I'm on a roll now, yeah, Kerry Guinan, and Megan Nolan. And we're going to finish this evening with the final piece from Molly Garvey, who's going to be singing a song, let me see if I can get this right, and Tiffany Dispiritu Santo.